are the great personalities who bring a memorable experience to glowing life. Samuel Goldwyn's masterpiece. The screenplay was written by Robert E. Sherwood, Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright of Petrified Forest and Idiot's Delight. From this, William Wyler, who won the Academy Award for his direction of Mrs. Miniver, wove a pattern of motion picture magic. With Myrna Loy and Frederick March living through the heartwarming second bloom of love, Dana Andrews and Teresa Wright feeling the breathtaking thrill of love at first sight, Hoagy Carmichael spreading his own brand of stardust. All of them together giving all of us the best years of our lives.
Hello and welcome back to the Film and Water Podcast, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and joining me for a very special episode, this is one of my favorite movies of all time. 1946's The Best Years of Our Lives, directed by William Wyler, is our friend David Fuhr. David, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
I'm very happy to have you back because, as I said, this is one of my all-time favorite movies. And one of the reasons I especially wanted to have you on is, of course, you were on like in the mid-70s. I forget what exactly number episode that was when we talked about The Seventh Victim. And that's another movie that I feel like a lot of people haven't seen, and I love it. And part of the reason I love it is because it's sort of relatively obscure. And I really wanted to make sure, like, I made the best possible case for that movie. That's why you were such a great guest. You had so many interesting things to say about it. That's kind of what we're doing for Best Years of Our Lives, because I saw this movie when I was in my early 20s when I worked at the video store, and I just fell in love with it instantly. And I've never not loved it. I think it's one of the best movies ever made. And for some reason, it's just not all that famous compared to some other movies from this era. And I've noticed that over time, when I have tried to explain this movie to people, when I've told them, oh, you know what's a great movie? The Best Years of Our Lives. And they'll say, oh, what it's about? And I'll say, oh, well, it follows the story of three returning veterans from World War II. Almost invariably, the people I would tell that to, their face starts to scrunch up a little, you know? Because it sounds like I've assigned them homework.
Right.
And I try and explain to them, no. I know it sounds heavy, but it really is a classic. And how long is it? 3 hours.
Okay. Yeah, that's a deal breaker.
Yeah, and I get so frustrated because I always feel like I'm not doing the movie a service by somehow being able to sell it the way I should. Because, I think this movie is a masterpiece. So I want you to help me do this sales job, David.
I will certainly do my best.
This movie. So, like, you know, when did you first see this movie? And, like, let's just get into it. Like, why do you love it so much?
Okay. Well, I definitely first saw it in, I'd say, early high school. I was an obsessed classic film fan. So I was watching every movie that came on PBS, there were, like, one or two every weeknight at that time in the 80s. So I was seeing all of those, but I was also going to every video store within a several mile radius of my house, raiding their classic sections. And I think it was at Zazu Super Video I found the...
Great name!
Yeah, I found the Samuel Goldwyn line of video cassettes for these. These were really nice... A nice line of video cassettes. They were kind of gleaming, and they had like
a golden embossed foil with his name and stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. So I rented it when I was about 14, and I was already a very keen sort of. I had a very keen interest in American history, and the 40s were a big interest of mine. A lot of that came out of even earlier being very engaged with Roy Thomas's All-Star Squadron comics.
Me too. So, yeah, me too.
Yeah, I mean, Roy did a lot to push people towards a fascination with history, I think.
Absolutely true. Yep.
Yeah, so that's when I rented it, and it was, you know, I knew I was going to like it because I liked a lot of the stars that were in it, and I knew I liked William Wyler from what I had seen before, but I don't think I expected to like it as much as I did. And I rented it numerous times after that. Finally, I found it for sale. I bought it. I've had it in various different media since then. And I've probably watched it 20 times at least in my lifetime. So that's 60 hours right there.
It's a big commitment, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned Samuel Goldwyn. This movie was inspired by Samuel Goldwyn when he read an article, I believe, in Life magazine or something similar, an article on returning veterans. And it was about how a bunch of veterans took a train home across the United States. And, like, basically, as each of them got closer and closer to their home, they would get more and more worried because they were worried about how to reintegrate back into their lives after being overseas for so many years. And that's basically the story of this movie. It said it follows our three soldiers, which are Al Stevenson, played by the great Frederick March, Fred Derry, played by Dana Andrews, and Homer Parrish, played by Harold Russell. Now, Harold Russell was not an actor. He was a real-life veteran who had lost both his hands in the war. And so he's here playing basically the same guy as this, a guy with this tremendous war injury. And, it follows just they don't know each other as the movie starts. They are thrown together by sheer fate because they're all sort of in the same clearing station where they're going to get sent home, and they end up in a plane together. It's sort of funny, like, how bare bones the trip is. I mean, they look like they're practically in the cargo hold.
Yep.
When they're thrown into this plane, and they get to sort of meet one another. And as I said, Al was an officer, Fred is a sergeant, and Homer, I think he was a corporal. I forget exactly what his rank is. And they get to meet one another, and then they find out that they all, of course, are from a similar part of the country. It's a made-up town. I believe it's in Ohio is where they say where they're from. And they follow them all as they reconnect with their families. And, yeah, like you, part of the reason I was attracted to this is because, yeah, much like you with Roy Thomas and All-Star Squadron, I had a real interest in the 40s, 40s Americana history. And, and the cast. I mean, aside from Frederick March, who has always been one of my favorites ever since I saw him in Inherit the Wind, this movie features Myrna Loy, one of my all-time favorite actors, period, from any era of the movie. She plays Al's wife, Millie. We've got Teresa Wright, another one of my favorites. She's the daughter of Millie and Al. Virginia Mayo plays Marie Derry, who is Fred's wife. And then we've got
Gladys George.
Gladys George as Hortense Derry. Hortense. I love that. Great name. Which is Fred's mother. And then waiting for Homer is his girlfriend, Wilma. So she's waiting for him, and he's got his family, and of course they all know about his injury. And so the movie is remarkably sort of plotless for a three-hour movie.
Yeah, it is.
It really is just sort of follows these three people through their individual story.
It really does. I mean, they took a big chance with that, I think. But it pays off so well because it really has the opportunity to take its time. And I guess, Wyler is really confident that you're going to find, these separate stories interesting, and you're going to care about these actors that he's putting in front of you. And I mean, I don't think he was wrong.
Yeah, it had some very unusual pacing. Is that, like, when they first meet, the scenes of them on the plane goes on for like a good 20 minutes. Like, it's a long sequence. It's very languid and relaxed, and it pace-wise, yeah, it's very unusual. You would think if the whole point of the movie is to get them home, like, you would get them home as soon as possible. But this movie takes its time, and I really find that very interesting to watch the three of them interact with one another. Because, of course, Homer doesn't want to be pitied. He's
right.
Hooked for his hands. I mean, the scene where we realize that Homer has the hooks is when they have to sign in for something. And, Homer reaches out and you see that he's got the hooks. And initially, Fred is like, "Do you want me to sign that for?" And he goes, "What, you think I can't sign my own name?" And, of course, he grabs the pencil in his hand and in his hook, and he's just shoots right through it. And right then and there, like, Fred instantly, you could see, he sort of bonds with Homer because Homer is letting Fred off, no pun intended, letting off the hook a little. Hey, it's okay. I know that this is awkward for you. This is awkward for me. So I'm going to make a joke about it. And they immediately bond. And then they bond, of course, with Al in the plane. So that whole intro is terrific.
Oh, yeah, and even before that, the sort of the scene where Fred is looking for a regular flight, and they've got that. There's a very political film, actually, I think it's worth stressing, even though, it's still kind of relevant in a lot of ways to current American politics. But, the way the emerging you know, sort of galvanized New Deal consensus was working in Hollywood and I think in the country at large. You see this sort of fat cat businessman who has all his golf clubs. And
yeah.
he's like, oh, no problem. I'll pay for all this extra baggage. Like, he's got a seat. Fred, you know, he's got a ride in the nose of this cargo plane because there's no actual flight for him or any of these other returning vets. And I mean, there's so much of that all throughout the movie. These kind of, they're kind of subtle, I guess, unless you're looking for them, then they kind of get more and more glaring. But I mean, Wyler's definitely making a point. Like, why have we set things up this way that these guys that made all these sacrifices are like left to scrounge for themselves to try to get home. And this guy is going on a golf vacation with no cares in the world, you know?
Yeah, that's it's a great little moment. And it really is. You know, you're like, why does Fred have to? I mean, we see that the depot where they're waiting, a lot of them are like sitting on the floor.
Some of them are not going to get home for weeks.
Yeah, it's a research right out with that kind of like. And you're right. This film is very, very political. There's a scene that we'll get to later on that is astonishing. In its bluntness. And that is one of the things that really made me take to this movie early on is that, you know, movies and of course in the 30s and 40s and the 50s before the codes, you know, before the Hays Code really got pushed out the door, you know, they had to be subtle.
Yes.
And they had to be, especially with, you know, sex and violence and just, you know, more adult material, but they had to soft edge things because they just couldn't get away. But this film is remarkably blunt. And I have to wonder if that isn't because the subject matter was so serious and seems so sort of like for the greater good kind of thing that censors kind of let things pass a little. I mean, and there's another scene later on again that we'll get to that I think is pretty astonishing in its bluntness in terms of sex. And this is a, you know, this is 1946. And so when the first time I ever saw this movie, I was really taken by that. It was one of the things that got into me was that it was just so straightforward.
Yeah.
And I loved all that. I mean, we follow them all home and we see that Al doesn't, they don't want to get home immediately. And Al makes the joke about, why don't we stop at that bar and get a drink? And, you know, Fred is like, no, you got to go. We're here now. We're going to see your family. So then he meets his family and he has a son and he has a daughter played by Teresa Wright and then Myrna Loy. And the scene where, because Millie doesn't realize her husband has come home. He comes in and the daughter is shocked and he kind of like whispered, like, you know, don't tell your mother. And there's a really beautiful sequence where we see down a long hall. And that's when Myrna Loy comes into the frame and she turns and she sees Al. And this is the first time she's seen him in, you know, however many years. And it's really beautifully staged. And apparently that is literally what happened to William Wyler when he came back from the war.
Really?
And he took that right from his life. And it's a really remarkable scene because it's Myrna Loy. Myrna Loy doesn't have a lot of lines in this movie. But by this point in 1946, she was pretty much the dream wife of the movies. She was, you know, she was Nora Charles and she played the wives in so many other movies. And so it was almost like once you've cast it right, you don't even have to give her much to do because you know who she is. She's the perfect wife. She's Myrna Loy. Yeah. Of course she is.
Yeah. And I mean, the Greg Tolan deep focus cinematography is, you know, invaluable in that scene and in so many others. But you've got like the kids in the foreground and the parents reuniting and at the far edge of the screen, but still completely in focus. It's remarkable stuff. It's so moving see them. And you know, they're all sort of joking about how it's actually harder to do this to get home than to storm the beaches at Normandy.
right.
And they're not actually joking. I think it probably is harder in some ways because, you know, nobody's actually ordering you out of the transport. Like, you have to steal yourself to do it and go see these people. And they're afraid they're not going to know how to be human beings anymore after what they've been through.
Right. Like we already see that how uncomfortable Al is because he knows how much older his kids are.
Oh, you know,
like he's all sort of shocked that his kids are, you know, they're like fully grown young adults now. And when he left them, he sort of perceived them as little kids. Of course, they weren't. I mean, he was only gone a couple of years, but still, you know, if you don't see your kid from 13 to 16, that's going to be a pretty different looking kid.
Yeah.
Then he left. And you mentioned, I'm glad you mentioned Greg Tolan. Yes, Greg Tolan is the cinematographer, one of the best guys ever to do it, a brilliant cinematographer. He worked on a film some of you may have heard of, Citizen Kane. And yeah, he was an expert at being able to focus in the foreground and the background simultaneously. And, you know, again, the age of digital photography, that doesn't sound all that impressive. But back then, when you're doing things with these old cameras, that was nearly impossible.
Yeah.
And Tolan was that good at it. And it gives this film a very particular look, a very unique look, in that, mm-hmm. you know, we're looking at the foreground and then we see something in the background and they are both in focus to a T. And that scene of them meeting early on is one of the first instances of Tolan really bringing his skills to bear in this movie.
Yeah. And that scene, I mean, staying with Al, the scene where he's got all this sort of bundle of things that he thinks his son is going to find interesting.
Oh, yeah, all the memorabilia. It's like
so brilliant. Yeah, like, yeah. I don't know if you've ever had a conversation with an older relative who thinks you're going to be interested in stuff that you're not interested in. Mm-hmm. But, like, it really captures it. Yeah.
Yeah, he's got all this stuff. He's, oh, I picked this up from
Samurai Sword.
Samurai Sword, yeah. The son is like, okay, Dad, right? What are we supposed to do with that?
Thanks for these things, Dad.
He's sort of like, okay, right, whatever. So we follow Fred, and Fred lives a very different life than the one Al lives, because we said Al is in banking, and we're going to find all about that later on. But Fred basically was a soda jerk. And
yep.
he lives in, my God, he lives in what looks like a shanty town. I mean,
I don't think they've got indoor plumbing.
Yeah. I mean, whoa, the town, or the little house where Fred comes to, it looks like something out of Robert Altman's Popeye. I mean, it's just really dank and depressing. And he lives with they never quite say, I get the sense that that's his biological father, but not his biological mother. Did you get the same read as I did?
Yeah, either the mother died or left at some point.
Right.
And yeah, Hortense is definitely like his stepmother. Or
he calls her Hortense, right? I think he calls her that. Yeah. Okay. He calls his dad, but he calls the woman Hortense. And they love him. I mean, it's a very loving, you know, they're happy to have him back. But it's a pretty grim life. And of course,
I think it's one of my favorite things in the movie, actually, how skillfully they've done this. Like, these are incredibly – I think they're very good people. They are proud of him. They care about him. They're not abusive or anything, but you understand why he doesn't want to be anywhere near them most of the time, because they're so depressed. His dad is never without a bottle next to him.
Yep.
And that's Roman Bonin, actually. I always like to mention him when I see him in a movie, because he never disappoints. He's an incredible character actor. And he was blacklisted later.
Oh.
But, you can see him. He's one of his best roles, I think, is in The Strange Love of Martha Ivers.
I've never seen that.
Oh, it's so good.
Barbara Stanwyck,
good.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's one of my favorite noirs. But in this one, I mean, it's a small role, but I don't know if I've ever seen anyone do such a great job with such a – like, it's a very particular character that could have been screwed up in so many ways, but I think he plays it so, so well. Like, he's such a sympathetic figure, but on the other hand, you just want to see him for a few minutes, and then you just got to get out of there.
Yeah, and Fred – another reason Fred is uncomfortable is that he has a wife that he – barely knows. She's played by, as I mentioned, Virginia Mayo, and they mentioned that basically they were together for like 3 weeks before he shipped out. So he's coming back to a stranger, to an absolute stranger, and that is going to, of course, cause some problems down the line. So then we also we follow Harold Russell coming back, and he lives a very Norman Rockwell, you know, classic middle class suburban existence. His family, when his family first sees him, it's really beautiful because his mother just starts to cry. And you know that she's crying tears of joy because she's so happy her son is back. But she's also crying because, you know, he's coming back looking the way he's mangled. You know, I mean, he's coming back, and they hug him, and that's a beautiful. And then so he meets that his girlfriend Wilma, who lives next door, and he has a little sister who runs around, and she's happy to see him. And so he looks like, okay, you know, he's got kind of a nice thing to come home to too. But I mean, of course, he's going to have his struggles because he's got so much other things to deal with. And instead, at that point, we're just following these three stories. As I mentioned, the film was directed by William Wyler. And one of the things that's, you know, so remarkable about this movie is that this was William Wyler's first film after he came back from World War II. Apparently, Samuel Goldwyn had offered this movie to John Ford. John Ford turned it down. And so they went to William Wyler, and Wyler had been in overseas and had lost some of his hearing thanks to being in a bomber plane where apparently the noise was quite literally deafening. And he was worried he wasn't going to have a career, not being able to direct actors anymore since he couldn't hear. And apparently Greg Toland, who is some sort of mechanical genius, set up something with the camera that allowed Wyler to be able to hear his actors through the film being sort of streamed through the camera. And it was just enough that Wyler could do it. And Wyler was gone. If you look at Wyler, and this is all covered in the documentary Five Came Back, which is on Netflix, which was a book by Mark Harris. It's one of my favorite nonfiction books I've ever read. The documentary is on Netflix. It's wonderful. But if you look at William Wyler's filmography, there's this giant gap where there's no feature films from 43 to 46. And so this is the first thing he did when he came back. And, like, you know, this is his story. This is this is absolutely his story of him coming back with a wound. I mean, in some of the analysis I've read of this movie, they talk about that each story, you know, Al's, Fred's, and Homer's, all of it is a slice of William Wyler's life. Because William Wyler came back partly damaged. He also came back to a very Tony lifestyle because he was a really famous Hollywood director returning to his, you know. So it's like he was able to have a slice of him in all of these characters as they come back and go through their paces.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Yeah. And, I guess the milieu that's going to serve as the way to keep getting them back together is Butch's bar. I guess that might be the place we should go from here, because we've it's the place that they all want to retreat to before they get home. And once they do get home and they get a bit restless, well, they wind up back there.
Yeah. They all end up in the bar. And we see right from the beginning that there's trouble because Al's drinking a little too much.
Way too much. Yeah.
He finishes his wife's drink. There's a great Myrna Loy has a wonderfully subtle moment where she reaches out to take a swig from her drink, and she notices it's empty, and she just throws this side-eye glance at Al, and it's very subtle. And it's, you know, there's like about something like seven or eight characters in the frame, so it's easy to miss. But if you know to look for her, you know that she's noticed that Al is already drinking, and he's a little too gregarious. And it's like when Fred and Homer come in, he's like, God, like he's super. He's just a little like, okay, let's rein it in a little, Al.
No, this is not thin man drinking. Mm-hmm. This is problem drinking.
Yeah. I never thought of it that way, but yeah, you're right.
I mean, it's problem drinking in The Thin Man too, but the movie just doesn't present it that way.
We never see any hangovers of Nick and Nora happen.
No. No. So yeah, they're all at this bar, which is owned by Hoagy Carmichael.
Yeah, of all people, Hoagy,
who has a wonderful little role.
Pretty good actor, I gotta say. He's not an actor. He's really terrific as Butch Engel, the guy that owns the bar. He's really good in this movie.
Yeah, I think so too. And he gives his little talk about the state of the world after the invention of nuclear weapons. And he really accurately conveys the fears of all Americans in 1946, I think.
Oh, man. He has that extraordinary run where he's like, yeah, we all just might die anyway in a giant fire. So what the hell? You're like,
He's just gently playing the piano, talking about nuclear Armageddon.
Like, oh, jeez. Oh, my God.
And so, yeah, the whole cast gets together there, and you start to see the first gleaming of, I guess, where the story's going to go or could possibly go. There's kind of attraction, I think, right away between Teresa Wright and Dana Andrews.
Yeah, he takes an immediate shine to Peggy because Teresa Wright. I always loved Teresa Wright. She had a really kind of great career. She plays Lou Gehrig's wife in Pride of the Yankees, and she's of course in Hitchcock's Shadow of a Doubt, which we've covered here on the show before. I've always liked her. I just think she's just a terrific actress, and you know, again, there's going to be another thing down the line about where she doesn't act like your typical 1946 young heroine in your movie, because we realize that Fred is married, and she knows Fred is married, and after he gets drunk and stays the night at the Stevenson's house, and she cooks him breakfast the next morning, there's a lot of flirting going on, and she knows he's married, but she's flirting with him anyway. She really likes Fred and doesn't really even try to hide it.
Oh, yeah, those scenes, I mean, as you were discussing before, the kind of unusual frankness that you see in the movie, overnight when he is having his nightmare about his friends who were killed, and she comes in to comfort him, and, I mean, it's just so, those scenes are so intimate, and then the next morning when she comes in, and he, or I guess it's all, is it all happening at the same time? I think maybe it is. I'm getting a bit muddled, but, like, you know, he says, "Who are you?" And she's like, "Peggy," and he's like, "Oh, yeah, Peggy," and he just sort of grabs her. She just says, like, "I'm not that Peggy." Like, yeah, I mean, it's just the tip of the iceberg. Obviously, we're supposed to assume all kinds of things there. Like, he has just had some drunken encounters in his life, possibly. Mm-hmm. And she is just unfazed by it, which you wouldn't expect in a movie at this time. But, yeah, yeah, she really just brushes it off. She's like, "Oh, yeah, he's just drunk. He'll fall asleep again." Yeah. I'm not scandalized.
Yeah, I think part of the reason I like Teresa Wright so much is that she has very wholesome kind of looks, and you would expect her to kind of be sort of like soft on film, but she generally played kind of tough gals, like deceptively tough gals.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, she threatens to kill serial killers if they
are exactly
staying in her home. I mean, yeah, no, she's remarkable. She's a great actress. So she wasn't even in that many movies, unfortunately. I guess she was doing a lot of stage work too. Mm-hmm. But every single movie she's in, just about, is memorable. Right up till Somewhere in Time.
That's right. She's in that. Right. She's in that. Her last film is The Rainmaker. With Matt Damon, yeah. Francis Ford Coppola. I love seeing her in there because you're like, "Oh, look, it's Teresa Wright. It's wonderful." But you mentioned the dream that Fred has about the parachute dream, and that whole scene, and in fact, even the dialogue is taken right from real life. Because if you watch William Wyler's, he made a couple of documentaries while he was overseas. That's why he was there. He made a documentary called The Memphis Belle about, you know, that squadron of planes that were dropping bombs. And if you watch Memphis Belle, and you can watch it, it's on Netflix. Netflix, along with Five Came Back, have all of these shorts available for watching. There is a sequence where a bunch of airmen, I should call them, are watching another plane start to go down. And you hear them talking to each other over the radio. And you hear them say, like, just sort of venting their frustrations at the guys that are still in the plane. They're like, get out, come on, man, come on, you know, Smitty, jump. And you're seeing, you know, this is real life war footage. You're seeing guys jump out of this falling plane, and you see their parachutes open, and they're like, basically, they know how many guys are in the plane, and so they're counting, you know. It's like, all right, 3, 4, you know, where's the other guy, blah 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 blah. And that dialogue is literally what Dana Andrews says in that dream. And
right,
that's the memory he's having. And I didn't know that until I watched Memphis Belle, which I only saw like a month ago after Five Came Back aired. And I was like, wow, you know, like that's literally taken out of something William Wyler saw for his own eyes. That is really unbelievable.
It is. And you actually, another interesting thing about this movie from, you know, thinking about gender and the way it's presented in films, you see men cry in this movie.
Yeah.
Which you don't see very often in movies from that era. I mean, it happens, but it's very rare. And I think Wyler's certainly making a point about this. These are people who can't just tough it out and handle these experiences without talking to someone or dealing with it in some way that is not you know, the traditional masculine way of handling adversity at that time, or even now, really.
But, right. I mean, it's by casting Dana Andrews in this part is kind of going against type, because Dana Andrews to this point had always played tough guys and detectives and Philip Marlowe and all those kinds of guys. And here he is. Mm-hmm. And then we said he finally does meet up back with his wife, who right off the bat, you know, something's wrong, because she doesn't even bother to be home when he comes back from the war. And, you know, she's got a job at a nightclub, and she's played by Virginia Mayo. And she actually utters the line to him at one point, "Can't you just get over it?"
Oh, yeah.
Which is really cuts like a knife, because initially everything is great. He's got a bunch of money from, I guess, like not the GI Bill, but he's got some money that the Army gave him. And
as an officer, I'm sure he was getting paid pretty well. Yeah.
Right. He's like, and he has like $1,200, which, you know, in 1946 money is pretty, that's a lot of money to have in cash. And he's like, "You're going to quit that job. We are going to live on the high life." And then, of course, it all goes to pot very quickly when the money runs out. And we find out that Virginia Mayo, really, her character, Marie, has no interest in her husband outside of him being a war hero. Because the first night he wears his regular suit, she's like, "Why aren't you wearing your uniform?" And he's like, "I'm not going to wear my uniform. That's in the closet now." And she's like, "Oh, come on. You'll look great." And you know this is not good. Like, she can't accept him for who he is as a man. She is looking at him as this sort of billboard that she can parade around. And, you know, Virginia Mayo, not somebody I'm terribly familiar with, but she was one of your sort of classic Hollywood stars. I give her credit for taking this part, because it's pretty unlikable.
It is. I mean, you could look at that two ways. I don't know. I think they could have done a little more to help us to sympathize with her. But, you know, that's not the decision they tried to go in. So they just turn her loose as kind of a – I mean, she's not an evil person. She's just got her own code of ethics that are – they do have that scene later on where she's talking to Teresa Wright about, you know her philosophy of life and how she deals with men. And it's obviously very different from Peggy's. But, you know, she's not a monster, but she's definitely not the right person to be married to Fred. And, you know, I mean, in a movie that was made now would, I think, try a little harder to interrogate Fred's ideas about, like, forcing her to quit her job, etc. But, you know, we sort of understand that it's all built into the script to show that these people are headed for a relationship crack up.
Right,
but I'm not automatically sympathetic when a husband says, "Now you got to quit your job. Now I'm home. I've got enough money for us." Right.
That's a weird moment. That is a very. Yeah. Like, why would you do that? Why would you even make that? Yeah. I mean, these are just two people that shouldn't be together, because again, they were married for 3 weeks and then he was gone for like 3 or 4 years. Well, no wonder their relationship is non-existent. You know? I agree. She probably could have been a little better fleshed out. But, I mean, the part as played or as written, she's not fun to be around. And I said, I give Virginia Mayo credit for playing that part, because it was probably not terribly fun to watch. And that's part of the reason that the minute that Peggy gets a wind of this relationship, she just decides, "I'm going to split them up." In fact, she literally tells Al and Millie, "I'm going to split them up." And I love their reaction. Al and Millie are just like, "Who are you to decide that?" And she is just defiant. She's like, they don't love each other. She's terrible to him. And you mentioned that scene where Peggy and Marie talk to one another. It's when they go on a double date. And Peggy goes out with this guy that she's not interested in. And they go to this incredibly crowded nightclub. It's one of the most uncomfortable. Like, it's people literally pushed in like at a Who concert in 1982. It looks like the most uncomfortable place to go to in history. And then they go to the powder room together. And there's this extraordinary sequence where it's all shot in mirrors where you can't exactly even tell which version is the real version of the two actors that are talking, because Wyler keeps changing the angles. And, you know, Peggy learns, you know, pretty much how Marie feels about her husband. And you get the sense that Marie knows too. That Marie knows that Peggy.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, I think she's got a good sense. I mean, I think she's pretty shrewd about these things. And yeah, she's like, you know, you've got Woody. He's like, you know, I guess, you know, country club scion and, you know, a good catch. So Peggy's all set. So just stick with that.
Yeah.
You know, don't start thinking about Fred. He's on his way down. He reached his peak when he dropped his bombs, and he's going back to the soda jerk world.
Oh, that scene. Oh, my God. When he has to try and go find another job, and he talks about how he can't, like, you know, the job interviewer is like, well, were you in charge of anybody? And he's like, well, not really. He's like, what did you do? Well, I basically dropped bombs.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, it doesn't make him eligible for any particular job. And he ends up getting a job back at the pharmacy, which is like one of the pharmacies of my dreams.
It is a beautiful pharmacy.
Oh, yeah. My God. It's like you could just live there. That's if I had lived in the 40s, and I'm not sure that I didn't in some reincarnated version, I would have spent all my time there because I would just be reading comic books and sitting at that counter with my ice cream sodas. I mean, the place is it's just gleaming and beautiful. It's one of the great sets. I mean, I just love the detail of it, all the stuff. So when he has to basically apply to – he's going to work for a guy that used to be his you know, his employee. And then he used to call – what did he call him? Not Stinky.
Yeah, it is. Stinky Merkel.
It's Stinky Merkel. And he's like – he keeps calling him Stinky, and Stinky's like, that's right out now, Fred. You know that Stinky, now that he has a chance to lord it over Fred, is going to exercise that power. It's a really brutal scene.
It is. Yeah. No, that – the soda fountain. Yeah. But I mean, Fred is, he's not helping himself either, right? Like, I mean, there's two ways to read that interview scene. Like the hiring manager, he's actually kind of trying very hard to give Fred some kind of out. So he's like, yeah, you're right. I did learn these other skills. And like, I mean, he's enumerating, I mean, he's kind of an annoying guy. The character's actor is playing him as unlikable, but his actual dialogue is it's kind of generous in a way. Like,
yeah,
he's not saying you can't work here because you just drop bombs. He's saying you must have done these other things. Like, let's go through it. Let's, you know, walk back over your career in the Air Force and figure out what else you did.
Yeah, you were in charge of people. You managed people. You ran a thing. Yeah, he is. He's trying to – and I should mention, just in terms of the connections to Citizen Kane, we already have one with Greg Tolan. This pharmacist is played by Erskine Sanford, who is in Citizen Kane. So I love seeing him again. I love to play that game where I follow Citizen Kane actors throughout their careers as they appear in things. And speaking of – we have another connection to Citizen Kane, of course, that Al's boss, the owner of the bank, is played by Ray Collins, who is in Citizen
Kane. Jim Geddes.
Well, boss Jim Geddes, famous boss Jim Geddes. And it's interesting you mentioned how the pharmacist is doing his best to be kind – to Fred. We have that scene mirrored in the scene where Al comes to basically pick up his job at the bank. And initially, Ray Collins could not be nicer to Fred.
Yeah.
He's Mr. Milton. And Mr. Milton could not be nicer to Al, because he's talking about, you know, well, we want you to head up our division of loans to veterans. You have a unique skill, and you'll be able to talk to these people. And they gives him a nice briefcase. He says, oh, we got you this briefcase. And he says, you know, take your time. You can have a vacation. You know, of course, you need time to decompress. And when you come back, your job is going to be waiting for you. And not only is it a job, it's a promotion from the job that he had before. So Al's all set up, and yet the way Ray – and it may be that I'm reading into it because I know Ray Collins from Citizen Kane. And I can't I can't separate him from being boss Jim Geddes. But it's like, to me, there's just a slight sinister cast to it. Everything is so – he's so nice to Al that you're just – you feel like there's something else that Mr. Milton might say.
Oh, yeah. Well, and Al is a very cynical banker from the beginning, right? Like, he's the one that says the most anti-banker stuff in the movie.
I mean, he's very Bernie Sanders. Like,
exactly, he is. I mean, and, you know, like the first morning there, he's sitting at the breakfast table and he's like, last week it was kill ethnic slur, unfortunately. This week it's make money, you know? So, like... Because you're right out of the army where you're fighting Japan, and now you're fighting to make money. And he knows what the bank is up to, so That's the way it goes.
Yeah, I mean, right. It's Al is clearly, you know, without it being stated. And again, it's one of the reasons, again, I like this movie, that it's, I've talked about how bold it is, but it's also very subtle in that,
yeah,
Al just doesn't basically buy into this. He can't say it, but he doesn't buy into this bullshit. He just can't.
No, he doesn't.
And it reminds me a lot of this, the final scene in the Hurt Locker, where, yeah, Jeremy Renner is in the supermarket. And he is confronted by the endless choices of food, and he, yeah, just can't – he's frozen. He can't make a choice because he's just so overwhelmed by the luxury, mm-hmm, in front of him when, yeah, he was, you know, dealing with life or death not that long ago. And here he is just he can't even pick what kind of ice cream he wants because it's just all so overwhelming. And so, yeah, so Al, right from the very beginning, is just not buying into this life anymore. And there's a great scene where they make him give a toast.
That is one of the centerpieces of the movie, for sure.
To all these high-class banking people, and Al just gets hammered and gives one of the most uncomfortable speeches you've ever seen. I mean, you're just it makes me cringe to watch it, and I'm not – you know, I know it's a movie. Yeah. You know, I can't imagine having been in that room, because he makes jokes about, you know – We lost that battle, but we won the war. And he's like, we're going to take that. My boss said, take that hill. Why? Because it's a hill. Well, of course. And it's just, the stories go nowhere. And poor Myrna Loy just looks like she wants to die because she's so embarrassed. It's brilliantly done by Frederick March.
Yeah, well, and he's kind of like subtweeting at Mr. Milton the whole time, right? Like, because they previously clashed over giving this loan to a farmer. Yeah, well, because it is. He's very passive aggressively continuing their battle that they've been having over whether they're going to give out loans to farmers with no collateral whatsoever, right? So, and he just, you know, he builds up to it, and he kind of just goes right over it and says, yeah, that's what we're going to keep doing until you fire me, at least. So, and because everyone's clapping, I mean, I guess he manages to keep his job for a while, because they're not really thinking about what this might mean to the depositors if everyone gets defaulted on. But
this isn't our money. This is the depositors' money. And yeah, yeah. That scene follows a great moment where a guy comes in for a loan and meets, yeah, with Al. And this guy is a farmer and he is a veteran. And him and
GI Bill is a factor.
GI Bill, right? And him and Al bond immediately. And he talks about, he's like, well, do you have any sort of collateral you could put up? He goes, no, I don't have any collateral. That's why I'm asking for the loan, is so I can, yeah, get collateral. And, yeah, Al initially is kind of like, I don't know. And then there's even a point during that scene, I think, where you see Mr. Milton like hovering in the background a little, which is just kind of like, okay. There's this great, again, to go with the deep focus photography. You see a lot of people in the background and think, you know, there's somebody commenting or watching what's going on. And then eventually Al decides to give the guy the loan.
Basically, yeah, well, Homer just comes in. He sees Homer in the middle of it. And I think that's kind of what pushes him over the edge. He's like, these guys, you know, they sacrificed a lot. And the country and, you know, the people who have the wealth in the country owe it to help create and sustain a real middle class. And, yeah, I mean, that's definitely the movie's message in terms of economics anyway. And so, yeah, that's what encourages him to do this and to stick with it after getting, you know, hauled onto the carpet by Mr. Milton and another sort of elderly figure who they're tisking him. And but, yeah, he kind of keeps going and with a little liquid courage, obviously.
Yeah, he's lubed up in virtually every scene that he can be lubed up in, because he keeps returning to the bar. He keeps going, yeah, back to the bar and stuff. And there's another great deep focus shot where after Al learns that Peggy and Fred are in a relationship, as much as you can be in one in a 1946 movie where one of the participants is married, there's a great scene where he is very straightforward with Fred, where, yeah, he's like, Fred, I'm going to do my best to bust this relationship up. And Fred immediately thinks it's because of class. You know, right. He's like, oh, is it because I'm from basically the wrong side of the tracks? And Al is like, no, it's not to that, because he's like basically saying, look, you're cheating on your wife with my daughter. And, you know,
it's not a good look.
Not a good look. It can't. I'm not going to let that. Because, and he basically is just saying, you know, kind of the idea is well, if you're going to, if you're willing to cheat on your wife or somebody else, what makes you think you're not going to cheat on my daughter? You know, I mean, it's like, and he doesn't come out and say it, but he's sort of saying, you know, if you're going to end the marriage, end your marriage, and then you can start seeing Peggy, but they can't overlap, you know?
Yeah.
And Peggy,
that's fair.
Peggy's not having that. Peggy goes to the pharmacist to get a like a malted or whatever, and so she's there. She fakes being a not the malt. She goes to get the perfume.
Oh, I love that scene. Yeah.
And I love the makeup cleanser. And he says so, and he has to pretend that she's a customer. That way, he can keep talking to her. And he's like, here's some foundation. And then here's some foundation remover. And he's like, well, I have a little tip for you. Don't buy the foundation. You don't need the foundation remover. And so, again, he is subtweeting that whole thing of just
– absolutely.
Undercutting what he's supposed to be doing, which is selling stuff to
people. Yeah, no, these people can't – none of them can buy into any of it anymore.
Right.
It's that's what being confronted with the abyss will do to you, I think.
Wow. I think that's pretty much true. And so Homer, we haven't talked a lot about Homer. There's Homer scenes of him. And, of course, any scene involving Harold Russell is sort of objectively a documentary. Because this is what his life is like. This is what this actor's life is like. And this is what the character's life is like. And so we see that Homer needs help to go to bed at night. He needs his father to help him go to bed because he needs to take off his pajama tops and he can do it. But we see how uncomfortable everybody is around him, but he is, he says he's okay with it and he makes jokes, but he clearly not as okay with it. Cause there is an extraordinary moment where he's kind of out in the shed and he's shooting targets, which already makes me nervous. Cause he's got his, he's loading a rifle with those hooks, which is just unbelievable that he can do that. And he's there with Wilma. And his little sister and their little friends were all like 5 or 6 or 7. They're all, again, with the defocus photography, they're outside through this window. And you can see them kind of muttering as they're looking in at Homer. And Homer notices and he gets so mad. He runs over, tries to open the door in a hurry, and he can't because of the hooks. And he gets so frustrated, he goes over to the window and smashes through the window with his hooks. And right then, Wyler switches the camera angle to where the camera is now placed where the little girl would have been. So your eye line is just below where the – and the hooks come in the frame. And you see, like, he tears up his sleeves because the broken glass is cutting through them. And it is – it's – I think that was probably the first scene when I saw the movie for the first time. I really like jumped back.
Oh yeah,
it's brutal,
startling. It's on a level with Jimmy Stewart trashing his house in It's a Wonderful Life. I mean, it's very unsettling. You just don't expect it.
Yeah,
he's been kind of disengaged from everything up until that point. You think the problem is that he's just not going to be able to, you know, to really be emotional and interactive with people. But the problem might be that he's going to completely snap and break things. And who knows what can happen after that. But I mean, it's kind of like a wake up call to himself as well. Like, I think he does sort of start to come out of it at that point.
Right, because he later apologizes to his little sister. He, like, says, I'm sorry, I know that you know. It's heartbreaking when he smashes the glass and she starts to cry. She's like, I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah.
He really has hurt her. And, you're seeing that it is a little, again, Wilma, too. Like, and Wilma is, like, to her, in her mind, nothing's changed.
Yeah.
She still loves Homer. She still wants to get married. And he just can't believe it. Like, he's just like, come on, Wilma, you know. You've got a whole life ahead of you. You don't want to get messed up with this. And he won't accept that she still loves him. And that's so tragic because it's like he just has to be receptive to this, but he can't because he's joking. Everything's okay. I'm fine. I can light a cigarette. I can take off my jacket. I can do this. And yet he's the one who is saying, I'm going to go basically have to go live in darkness somewhere and be away from everybody because I'm such a monster.
Yeah.
Wilma's trying to, she's trying to get through to him.
Yeah. And he is really stonewalling her through most of this movie. And that's definitely, it's well done. I mean, he's not a professional actor, but he's remarkably well integrated into.
Oh, he's terrific in this movie. Yeah. And I had read that apparently during the filming of this movie, it was somebody up in the studio, whether it was Sam Goldwyn or somebody else, sent Harold Russell to acting classes.
Oh, really?
And William Wyler, when he learned that, hit the roof.
Yeah.
Because he was like, no, I want him to be natural. And you know, and Harold Russell has a lot of heavy lifting to do in this movie.
He does.
Lot of big emotional scenes. And there's a scene, the scene where we see what he has to go through at the end of every night. And that's the scene where he basically breaks down with Wilma and lets her in to his life. And we're kind of jumping ahead a little bit on this, but then I think it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Where she follows him to bed and helps him take off his pajama top. And then he takes off his hooks because the hooks are attached by like a vest.
A harness.
A harness. That's a better word for it. And she takes them off and puts them off to the side. And that's when he points out, without my hooks, I'm as helpless as a little kid. You know, if there's a fire, I can't get out of this room. You know, like he is now completely helpless without those hooks. And she helps put him to bed. And I, first of all, just the idea of seeing an unmarried couple in bed together. Now, she's not sleeping, but she is sitting there in bed with him. That's a little pushing it for 1946.
It is.
and I feel like the subtext of that scene is by him showing her the intimate details of what she is in for every night of their life together. It's sort of him saying, this is what our sex life is going to kind of be like. I mean, to me, that's a sex scene without the sex. He's revealing to her the intimacies of how their bodies are going to work together. And it's a pretty startling, again, for 1946, pretty blunt for, and it's, you know, because it's done in 1946, it's classy as all get out. But it's a pretty blunt scene for a movie that you know, you couldn't show things like that back then.
No, I agree. And Kathy O'Donnell does a wonderful job, too, of
believably
conveying that, you know, that this love that she has for him is not going to be. I mean, it may be she's obviously upset for him, but she's not fazed by it.
No. Yeah, she's – I mean, you know, she isn't given a whole lot to do in this movie. She's kind of she's sort of straightforward through the whole thing. But like as you said, I think she does a great job. Kathy O'Donnell does a great job in the role because it's you get the sense that, you know, she's obviously she's upset by what happened, but she is trying to be strong for him because she gets a beat on him immediately that he is hiding, you know.
Yeah.
And again, in all the scenes where he is with Al and Fred, he's again making the jokes, and there's this whole long scene where he lights a cigarette. Which is remarkable. And the movie just stops and watches him do this. And again, it becomes a documentary at that point where, you know, you just watch him do these things. And they're later on in the scene where he is sitting and Hoagie Carmichael is playing the song. That's another one of those great moments of the deep focus photography, because that's also the scene where Al tells Fred, stay away from my daughter. And he's like, I got to go make a phone call. And we see Dana Andrews and Harold Russell in the foreground and Frederick March in the background, seeing him perfectly making that phone call. And it's just, again, the extraordinary photography by Greg Tolan.
Indeed. That is one of the great scenes. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, and the way that they're constantly sort of meeting up and, you know, checking in with each other. They can actually talk with each other, these guys, I mean, about the different, especially Homer and Fred wind up having several very important discussions. And I mean, like that scene where Homer decides to actually tell Wilma what's going on with him. Like he's kind of prompted by Fred to do that.
Right.
Who's finally, you know, he is pushed to the point where he realizes he does have to leave his wife. After coming home and finding her with Steve Cochran, a weaselly actor who's always good. He's kind of got an Elvis look about him, actually.
He does. He has a little bit of 50s greaser guy. But you know what? Even that scene, I love that guy is given some dignity, because we find out that guy's a veteran, too. He's not just a guy that's out on the prowl for married women. He's a veteran too, and clearly he and Marie are probably a much better pair than Fred are. They just happen to be not married to the right people. But I think that's a great little moment, too, for that character.
Oh, yeah, I agree. And their little exchange, Dana Andrews is asking him if he is having any trouble getting readjusted. And no, he says, not especially, no.
Yeah, he just handles it. He's like, it's okay.
I take things in my stride, you know. But who knows what private suffering he's enduring. The movie just doesn't have a chance to go into it.
Yeah, right. It's not a 5-hour movie. We can follow all these people. But yeah, Fred is clear. I mean, all of them are all suffering from PTSD or shell shock, as George Carlin liked to refer to it as, in their own ways. Fred is the most, Al's is more subtle because he's drinking way too much and he can't rein it in. And he's always doing all these sort of sarcastic asides and stuff. Fred is the most obviously troubled and saying, you know, Homer is too. I mean, Homer's injury is apparent, but he seems dealing with it the best. But again, so they've all got their own sort of issues to it. And there's there's a couple of extraordinary. Well, there's so many extraordinary scenes in this movie, but I mean, there's two scenes that I think about in terms of dealing directly with sort of the anger bubbling to the surface. And the one scene, I guess I should go in order. And the one scene I'm thinking of is at the pharmacist, where, oh my Lord, this scene, the pharmacist, where Fred is there serving the sodas and Homer's there reading the newspaper, or not reading the newspaper. He's just there hanging out with Fred. And there's this guy at the pharmacist counter, and he orders a meal, and he's reading a newspaper, and he's in a black hat and a black coat, and the way Wyler constructs the scene, it goes on for a while before you even see the guy's face.
Yeah.
And there's something like the guy is like the specter of death in this scene, because he notices Homer's hands, and Homer immediately says, "Oh, you're going to ask me about my hands. Everybody does. Don't worry, I'm not offended. I didn't like my old hands. They were in a lot of trouble. I had to trim my nails. So I traded them in for these models." They work with radar. And then this guy starts going on this whole run about how we were bamboozled into the war by, what does he call them? He doesn't call them liberals. He calls them socialists. He says some radicals.
Yeah, radicals in Washington.
In Washington. And he's like, we didn't want to fight the Nazis. We didn't want to fight the Japs. And he's basically – and he says to Homer, you lost your hands for nothing.
Yeah.
Whoa. I mean – and he has a newspaper. And we never see the newspaper up close, but he keeps pointing to it. And he's like, you read the truth, buddy. You read the truth. And he keeps – wagging his finger at this newspaper.
Yeah, it's Breitbart.
Exactly. I'm like, it's Fox News in newspaper form.
Yeah.
And it is an that scene is a gut punch because of just the idea, the effrontery of a guy talking to someone who lost both his hands in a war and saying, you did it for nothing. And of course, Homer is beyond offended and says, all those guys that went down on my ship, they died for nothing. And the guy won't give in.
No.
And he's like, yeah, they basically all died for nothing. And Fred has had enough. And Fred, of course, in classic Dana Andrews hero style, socks him one. And it's an amazing stunt because the guy takes a header onto this glass case and it shatters into a million pieces. It's oh my God. You just so want to beat the living crap out of that guy.
Yeah, I don't know if I've ever seen a film that's not an action film that has such a visceral punch scene in it. I mean, it really packs a wall up, literally.
Yeah.
And of course, that's the end of Fred's life at the drugstore. Yeah,
for some reason, he can't keep his job as a server after he punches out a customer and smashes
and
him
and breaks
the
glass counter. Yeah.
that scene is unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, it sort of weaves into the pattern of the film's politics very nicely, and it punctuates a lot of things that the film's kind of been leading up to. And of course, the discussion after that between Homer and Fred is a lot of it is about making sure that the people in your life that you do care about, you keep them around instead of alienating them like Homer's been doing. And it works out. And, of course, Fred suggests right there that he'll be the best man at the wedding if Homer's able to to work himself up to the point of making that happen.
Yeah, so. I think he even says, "I'll stand up for you if you do it. I'll be there." It's a really sweet moment, and it's a great counterpoint to the viciousness of what we just saw. I mean, I said I grew up. You know, history is written by the victors, of course. And, you know, I grew up, as you talk about, reading All-Star Squadron. And, you know, I never got the sense that anybody was anything other than in complete support of World War II. But, of course, that isn't true at all. There were large swaths of people. We were all very isolationist and all that stuff. And to see it in a movie in 1946 and just the way that actor plays that part, he's just so unrepentant. He never even says to Homer, "Look, man, I'm sorry, but this is the truth." Like, he's just brutal to Homer. And Homer is so sweet and so kind. It's like kicking a puppy. And
it is.
The guy is just such an unrepentant dick that you are so happy when he gets it. And so,
he's definitely an America Firster of the Lindbergh stripe.
Yeah. Oh, man. It is in a movie full of great scenes. That scene is unbelievable. And so as the film sort of winds down, we get the sense that, you know, that Homer's going to be okay. And then we find Fred he is so distraught and is so lost that he decides to take a plane out. And he says, "I want the first plane out." And they're like, "Where?"
Yeah.
He says, "Doesn't matter. Just first plane out." Because he just wants to just start a new life. And it's after he says goodbye to his father.
Oh, that scene is amazing.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Hortense, where they talk about the medals. That he has, and it's really sad. And they don't even argue with him, which is interesting. I think they get a sense of how lost he is. They don't even – I mean, maybe that's a scene that we just don't see.
Well, the dad does say, you know, "Don't you think it might be better to try to slug it out on your own home ground a little longer?" But that's the best he can come up with.
Yeah.
But no, they let him go. Maybe they think it will be better for him. I don't know.
Yeah, he's almost going to be like a hobo almost. And that leads that leads to this really wonderful moment where he goes to an airplane graveyard. He's killing time, and it is a field full of unused aircraft and the kind of aircraft that he used to fly in. Mm-hmm. And apparently the screenplay, we should mention the screenplay, it was written by Robert E. Sherwood, based on a novel by McKinley Cantor. And apparently this scene has no writing, like no dialogue, no nothing, because apparently Robert E. Sherwood said to Wyler, "You have to direct this. Like, you have to figure out how to shoot this because I can't write this. I don't know anything about this." And, you know, this film is very – William Wyler is not known for particularly sophisticated – hold on, let me take that back. I don't want to say sophisticated, notable setups. It's not like Citizen Kane with lots of shots that call attention to themselves. William Wyler was very simple. His stuff tends to look like Norman Rockwell paintings, very straight ahead. Howard Hawks is big on this too. Medium shot generally, you know, not a lot of fancy stuff. And I'm not mocking the fancy stuff because, good Lord, Lord knows I love Citizen Kane. But William Wyler's stuff is just very simply composed. But this scene is when he sort of digs in deep and goes for something very cinematic as this wonderfully slow push in over the back of Dana Andrews as he's sitting in the cockpit. It's extraordinary.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And the music, the sound design as well, really gets you into Dana Andrews' subjective headspace in a very effective way.
Yeah, it's a really wonderful. And that's the moment where Fred is sort of rescued because there's a guy who's like, "Hey, what are you doing? You know, get out of there. Get out of there." And he ends up getting – and I love even how brutal that guy is where he's like, you know, "I'm a veteran." He's like, out of work, huh? Like, you know, "I need a job." And the guy is not even terribly sympathetic to him. Like, he's just kind of –
well, and they're like sassing each other.
Yeah.
But you see, this is kind of the counterpoint to that scene with the chain store manager who didn't know or whatever. Their dynamic was wrong. They weren't able to talk to each other in a way. Because obviously Dana Andrews could have learned to do something at that pharmacy that was better than being the soda jerk.
Right.
But here he feels like he can talk about it, both because of the experiences he's been through throughout the movie and also because he's talking to someone who's been through the same stuff as he has. And he's like, "Look, if I learn to fly bombing raids over Germany, I can learn to help you with your construction company."
Yep.
And the guy's like, "Yeah, that's good enough for me."
Yeah.
He doesn't say it so jovially, but that's the upshot of it. Like, they hire him.
Right. So, he yells out to another guy. He's like, hey, Phil, or whatever. And you know that Dane Andrews is finally going to get kind of a job to sort of occupy his mind and be able to get through this. And instead, it's great. It's a great, because you want it, you don't want Fred to leave. You know,
no.
You know that Fred is going to do better with Peggy, and Fred is going to do better with Al and with Homer. And you just want them to stick around each other, and you don't want to see him take off and just sort of be on the rails or whatever. And so when he finds that job at this moment, you're like, this is terrific. And it's kind of interesting as the film winds up, because it ends, the final moments are of Homer's wedding. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's funny, Al's storyline, considering that Frederick March was pretty much, I guess, the biggest name, or him and Myrna Loy were certainly the marquee players of this movie, his story doesn't really wrap up. I mean, we get a little hint of that where they talk about the punch that's got booze in it, and he is going to abstain from that. And so you get the sense that, oh, okay, he's maybe getting a little bit of a handle on the drinking. But but we really don't get a much of a resolution to his storyline. And that's one of the things I like about it. I like that it, you know, it doesn't wrap everything up in a nice bow. It's like, well, no, these guys are going to have kind of ongoing problems.
Yeah, and he's not going to beat Mr. Milton. The best he can do is fend him off and give out a few loans that maybe Mr. Milton doesn't like every once in a while. But he's not going to take over the bank and start opening the vaults.
Right.
I mean, it would be nice, but that's not what's going to happen in reality. So.
Yeah, it's going to be a constant struggle for him to sort of do the things he wants. Because, as he said, if it was up to Al, he would just give all the money away to all the all the veterans that come in, and he can't do that. I love that kind of part of it. And I read something online about that. Apparently, the author James Baldwin apparently criticized this movie later on and said that this is sort of a failed, he called it like a failed liberal fantasy that, you know, basically a wedding and just hanging out with your buddies is going to solve, you know, coming back from a war. And, you know, far be it for me to argue with James Baldwin, I don't agree with that assessment, because I said, I think, yes, this movie does put somewhat of a period on the sentences of Homer and Fred, because you get the sense Fred is going to be with Peggy and she's going to be good for him, because she doesn't buy his bullshit. That is one of, like, there are times where he tries to be charming and tries to be a little slick, and she just cuts right through it.
Yeah.
So you get the sense that Fred's going to have a good support system around him, and that's going to be good for him, and Homer's going to have his support system, and Al's story is a little more unresolved. But the movie does come to some sort of a conclusion, but it's hardly a, oh, hey, we've solved World War II. the end. That's not the way this movie goes. So I don't think that criticism is terribly valid.
I'd like to – where did you read that?
I found it online somewhere. I was reading a bunch of articles about this movie, and apparently – I don't know when James Baldwin said it, if he said it at the time or later on or fairly, really, quote-unquote, recently. He's not around anymore. He criticized this and a couple other movies and called them, like, again, failed liberal fantasies of sort of fixing problems just through being nice or something like that. And
interesting. No, I'll have to take a look at that. No, I agree with you. I think the movie is more complicated than that. I can see how, if you want to read it that way and sort of look at a pattern of Hollywood films that end in marriage, that might seem to solve a lot of problems. But I think the weight of the 2 hours and 50 minutes before that, it doesn't dissipate.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, the last thing that Fred says in the last dialogue is that, like, we're going to go through hell trying to survive for the next 10 years. I mean, it's not like everyone's going to be happily ever after in such a saccharine way. I don't take it that way.
Yeah. And that was one of the things that made me love this movie, is that it just has that kind of nice into it. And it just has a very real feel to it. For as Hollywood a movie as this is, it was produced by a major studio, features major stars. Just has a wonderful, real feeling. But one of the details I didn't mention as we were starting out is that one of the ways that William Wyler went for this verisimilitude was that he instructed, first of all, he built all the sets to scale. Normal Hollywood sets are like 1.5 up from real life, but these sets were real. They were all real size rooms of way it would be. And he instructed specifically Myrna Loy and Teresa Wright to go buy their own clothes.
Oh, yeah.
Gave them money, and they went out and bought stuff right off the rack. No Edith Head costumes here. This was real-life stuff because he wanted these people to appear real, and I think it works like gangbusters.
It really does. No, I mean, it does feel like you're opening a window onto 1946. It does. Another movie, actually, if I might throw in a plug, maybe you know this movie. In case you don't, though, I'm sure you would be interested. It's Till the End of Time.
I have heard of it, but I've never seen it.
Oh, it's remarkable. It's a great sort of double feature with this one because it's dealing, and in some ways it's got a harder edged look at it's the same year. It's Guy Madison, who's kind of a limited actor, but it works pretty well. And Robert Mitchum, and these.
Wow, really?
Two guys coming back after the war. Robert Mitchum has a giant, steel plate in his head.
Oh, my God.
And, is not very well. And Madison is sort of a suburban kid who's not damaged physically by the war, but very much changed by it. And a lot of it revolves around the interactions they have with Dorothy McGuire, who's sort of a very troubled war widow.
Wow.
And they have a lot of really interesting scenes in that film, and actually some pretty harrowing scenes that are right up there with the drugstore encounter with the fascist.
Wow, that's remarkable. Yeah, the minute you mentioned Robert Mitchum, I just realized that I'm going to be able to sell this to my girlfriend because she loves Robert Mitchum. I'm like, okay, great. This is good. All right, I know what we're going to be watching now.
And it's directed terrific. By Edward Dmytryk, who was an excellent director, one of the Hollywood Ten, right? So this was leading up to getting ousted for a while.
And he did Crossfire with Mitchum.
Yeah, exactly. So this is like the year before.
Wow. Oh, wow. Yeah. All right. Terrific. That's a great recommendation. Thank you. Yeah, this sounds terrific. I'm going to try and track this down. That sounds great. It would make that's very interesting that this, I mean, it's funny, again, I don't know why I always feel like I have to plug this movie or defend it, because it was certainly recognized at the time. It was a massive hit. It was, in fact, the most
popular. Big Oscar winner, yeah.
Big Oscar winner, won 7 Oscars. William Wyler won Best Director, and considering that his previous film was Mrs. Miniver, where he won the Best Director Oscar for that, he essentially won back-to-back directing Oscars. Now, there were Oscar ceremonies in between, but in terms of his film career, he won back-to-back directing Oscars. It won Best Picture. This movie has another asterisk to it, and that is the only film in movie history that features an actor winning 2 Oscars for the same role. And that is Harold Russell, because Harold Russell was nominated for Best Supporting, and apparently Hollywood was so sure he was going to lose, they gave him a special Oscar as a sort of commemorative, saying, for bringing hope and dignity to all of our returning veterans. And they gave him that Oscar, and then he won the Oscar for Best Supporting Actor. So he ended up with 2 Oscars that night, and it's the only guy ever to do it. And apparently they changed the rule after that. You can't do it anymore.
Right.
Well-deserved.
Oh, sorry. Very much deserved. Yeah.
Oh, everybody's terrific in this. And Frederick March was nominated. And it is, the film is not forgotten. It's on it's number 37 on the AFI list of great films. I'm 37, right. Pretty high. But it's, for just whatever reason, when I hear people talk about the great films, you hear Casablanca and Citizen Kane and Gone with the Wind and Lawrence of Arabia. And this film, I just feel like this film doesn't get mentioned all that much. And I don't know. It's just, when I've mentioned it to people, they haven't heard of it or they haven't seen it. And that's why I'm always just such an advocate for it, because I really think it's a masterpiece. It's a 3-hour movie that never drags, it never fails to hold my interest. And that's all the more remarkable when he said it really is just a human drama of people interacting for 3 solid hours. But man, this thing, I just never, ever get tired of watching this movie.
No, me neither.
Yeah, it's really, really wonderful. And it said it's as fresh today as it would be. It's a 70-year-old movie, but to me it is, works just as well as you could say with about Coming Home or the Hurt Locker, any movie about returning war veterans and trying to, you know, adjust, this movie is right up there. It's just an absolute great, great movie. And so, you know, David, I guess we're going to wrap up here. Thank you so much for coming on to talk about this. You sent me a list of movies you wanted to talk about, and this was on there. And I said to you at the time, I really want to do this one, but I held off because I was like, I want to make sure I do it right. You know, I want to make sure I have all the notes in my head sort of spelled out because this movie deserves like my full attention. And so, so thank you. This was so much fun to talk to you about this.
Oh, my pleasure. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you. I can't wait to have you back on. That list you sent me, I mean, my God, we could just do just you on the show for like the next year and we're not be repeating any titles. So maybe when I track down until the end of time, we'll have to come back and talk about that one. So
that would be great.
Yeah. In the meantime, where can people find you on the internet? What are your other podcasts?
Well, we have my girlfriend and I do a podcast called Another Kind of Distance, which has generally been about time travel films. We also had a comics podcast that we were doing on a different feed, and now we've integrated them all into one feed because it's much cheaper to do it that way. So there we talk about 80s comics from a nostalgia perspective, comics we liked in the 80s when we were kids. And actually, the podcast for the next little while is going to be a Twin Peaks podcast.
Oh, okay, the Showtime?
Yeah, so we just put out our episode about Fire Walk With Me as a primer to get ready. And we're going to do an episode every week covering season 3 of Twin Peaks. So we're quite excited about that because it's a longstanding. David Lynch is a longstanding favorite and eager to see what he comes up with for maybe his final triumph. He says he's not going to make any more movies.
Yeah, so I just saw that. Yeah, he said retroactively in the Inland Empire is it. That's the last.
Yeah.
I love the deep dives you guys did on New Teen Titans. Were really fun. Those were really, really fun shows.
We just did Amethyst after that, and we're supposed to do Animal Man soon, which I'm very excited about.
Oh, wow. I love that book. Cool.
Yeah, it's probably my favorite series, so. The Grant Morrison 26 issues. So, yeah, we'll see. We'll see if Elise likes those. Because it's usually one or the other of us who loved these things when we were kids. Right. And the other one is seeing it for the first time. So, yeah, the Amethyst experience was interesting because I had never gotten a chance to read those. And I really enjoyed them. But, yeah, so that's the podcast, Another Kind of Distance. It's out there on iTunes and Stitcher and all the other places to find podcasts.
All right. Very cool. Well, as always, you can find all the episodes of this show over on our network site, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com. And if you just want to talk movies in general, you can go to the Twitter feed, which is @filmandwaterpod. So, David, thanks again for coming back on. I was really looking forward to this, and I wanted to get it in before we got to episode 100. There was a couple, like, big movies. I'm like, I got to get to Best Years of Our Lives. So thanks so much for coming back on. And thanks, everybody, for listening. And until next week, that's a wrap.
About a ham and cheese on whole wheat, without any mustard.
Ham and cheese, Doc. Save the mustard. Coming up. There you are.
Hi, Fred.
How have you been? Glad to see you.
Say, Fred.
Yeah?
What happened at Butch's?
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, you and Al. Was there any trouble?
Oh, no. We were just having a little friendly chat. There you are, sir. Thanks. What'll yours be, Homer?
Oh, I don't care. Give me a chocolate sundae.
Okay.
Hi.
How are you, soldier?
Sailor.
Excuse me. Say, you mind if I ask you a personal question?
I know what it is. How did I get these hooks and how do they work? That's what everybody says when they start off. Do you mind if I ask you a personal question? Well, I'll tell you. Got sick and tired of that old pair of hands I had. You know, an awful lot of trouble washing them and manicuring my nails. So I trade them in for a pair of these latest models. They work by radar. Look. Pretty cute, eh?
You got plenty of guts. It's terrible when you see a guy like you that had to sacrifice himself. And for what?
And for what? I don't get you, mister.
Well, anything else for you?
Check. We let ourselves get sold down the river. We were pushed into war.
Sure, by the Japs and the Nazis, so we
had... No, the Germans and the Japs had nothing against us. They just wanted to fight the Limeys and the Reds. And they would have whipped them, too. We didn't get deceived into it by a bunch of radicals in Washington.
What are you talking about?
We fought the wrong people, that's all. Just read the facts, my friend. Find out for yourself why you had to lose your hands. And then go out and do something about it.
You better pay your check, brother, and go home.
Well, who do you think you are?
Pay the cashier right over there.
Coffee, please.
Yes, ma'am. And that's another thing. Every soda jerk in this country's got an idea he's somebody.
Look here, mister. What are you selling anyway?
I'm not selling anything but plain old-fashioned Americanism.
Some Americanism. So we're all a bunch of suckers, eh? So we should have been on the side of the Japs and the Nazis, eh?
Again, I say, just look at the facts.
I've seen a couple of facts. I've seen a ship go down and over 400 of my shipmates went with it. Were those guys suckers?
That's the unpleasant truth. And the sooner we get wise to it, the better off we're going to...
Oh, if I only had my hands. You put those down!
Take your hands off of it.
Maybe I get through, please. Go get the druggist.
What happened?
It was Fred Derry. He hit him.
Bring some aromatic spirits of ammonia, iodine, and bandages.
Yes, sir.
Don't say it, chum. The customer's always right, so I'm fired. But this customer wasn't right. I'll meet you outside in a minute, kid.
Come on.